Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Mehdi Sangvaji. I'm a host with the New Books Network, and today I'm very pleased, excited, and honored to have Professor Critchley here. And he doesn't need really introduction for the people in the know, but here we go. Professor Critchley is the Hans Jonas Professor of Philosophy at the New School for Social Research, which I recently found out among its founders were John Dewey and Thorsten Duplin. Which is amazing. And Professor Critchley has written a lot on very diverse issues, all cool, all good. And he has written on the ethics of deconstruction, Derrida and Levinas, very little, almost nothing, death philosophy literature. He has written a book specifically on the death of philosophers and how they died, some of them hilariously tragicomic. Ethics, Politics, Subjectivity, Essays on Derrida, Levinas, and Contemporary French Thought, Continental Philosophy, a very short introduction, Continental Philosophy, a very long introduction, actually, also, On Humor, the name speaks for itself, Things Merely Are, Philosophy in the Poetry of Wallace Stevens, Infinitely Demanding, the book of Dead Philosophers, On Heidegger's Being and Time, How to Stop Living and Start Worrying, one of his most favorite books of all time. And the book we are going to talk about today, The Faith of the Faithless, Experiments in Political Theology. It came out in 2012 from Verso, and by the mercy of God, nobody decided to do a podcast on until I came along. So... Professor Critchley, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Okay, so Professor, you...
Call me Simon.
Absolutely. Simon, you have introduced yourself as, one time at least, as half that obsessional, inhibited, self-hating Englishman who hates England. And I'm sure none of it is true, but the last part, self-hating, the last part, hating England, that comes in handy. There's a quote from Rousseau. We may get to quote him extensively, probably. Also talking about how the English are wrong to trust the parliamentarian way of looking at. Politics. So my first kind of marginal question is, how does you being an Englishman who writes English help the book?
Help the book?
Yeah.
Don't know. My hatred of England has been consistent throughout my life. So. It informs this book as it does the you know, the flip side of love. So it, you know, the hatred conceals a, if you like, a sentimental attachment to the place I'm from, but enormous disappointment with it. So I don't think that whether this book is particularly informed by that, I don't really know. No, not really. No, there are more. There are more English loathing books than this one. But, I have an awful lot to say about this, but everybody happens to come from a place. I see no particular reason to celebrate that fact.
Exactly.
Whoever it may be. And that's just a fact about me. So I'm from England. And the nice thing about being from England is you can't really feel good about it unless you're or malevolent. So it's a good nationality to have, because you can't, we fucked everybody over at one point or another. So, yeah. So I have a very ambiguous relationship too. And it's partly informed by my family, all from Liverpool. And Liverpool has always seen itself as a city that is in England, but not of England. So that, a port city, yeah, right. So that's very important to some kind of background sense of where I'm from. And to that, with that in mind, that's sort of why New York is home for me, and it's a convenient home because it's also a port city, and a city that's not a capital city, but a city of capital, a city of commerce, and culture, and money, yeah. And there's something more honest about that than living in a metropolitan capital city.
Exactly. So the subtitle of this book is Experiments in Political Theology. In it, you go through many different political experiments and try to situate them in their own time, as well as how they can help us or what they could mean to us. You complement them, you criticize them, you put some of them together, you find familial kinship between them. At some point, was there a big chunk of what you liked in history of political philosophy that you had to put aside to close the book, or is it almost all of the?
That's a good question. I mean, I think maybe I invested too much time and love in Rousseau. Although I'm fascinated by Rousseau, and there's lots of things that I don't really I don't really deal with. I mean, I could have spent a lot more time thinking about Hobbes, which in a sense feels in a sense more relevant because of the way in which we've our kind of new love affair with the state and as a kind of person having a personality, and what's happened in politics in the last years, particularly with COVID, is a kind of reinforcement of state sovereignty, which is where someone like Hobbes comes in. But could have been more on that, and I don't really know. I mean, it happened the way it happened. I can tell you how it happened if you like to sort of story of the genesis of the book, or at least the way it was written.
Okay, so can we do it in a form of question? Because I had this question in mind to ask you if, would you be comfortable calling yourself an anarchist, as in a noun form?
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome.
As long as that's understood as a kind of, I'm interested in kind of weak and hopeless forms of anarchism, really.
Yeah, I know.
I'm dressing up in black outfits and I'm more interested in people digging in their gardens and working things out together, and the kind of social practices which make that possible, traditions of mutual aid, which don't really, the interesting, yeah. So I'm happy to think of myself as having an attachment to the anarchist tradition. Yeah.
Right. So then the question I had was, like, was there an aha moment? Was there a Damascene moment for you that you said, okay, I think I'm an anarchist? Or was there like a bruised thing? Like, was there always in you or just came out suddenly?
I think it emerged over time. In many ways, the prehistory of the book and the prehistory of, you know, what happened, what I was doing before the book was that, you know, a sense of what was wrong politically. And that for me meant working within a conventional party structure. So I worked for many years in a very kind of ordinary low-level way in the Labour Party in Britain, in my local constituency. And the failure of that, or the way in which, you know, 20 years of defeat of the Labour Party led to victory in the form of Tony Blair.
Blair, yeah.
And dealing with that, and then a resurgence of interest in more radical forms of politics in the late 90s, which was very much linked to where I was in the University of Essex at the time and living in England. And books like Hart and Negri's Empire, you know, had a lot of, you know, there was a lot of discussion around books like that. And there was a kind of radical turn then, which was focused around, you know, movements against globalization. People were obsessed with the Zapatistas, with what was happening elsewhere. In Iran, in all over the place. So this sense of which there were low-level popular movements and forms of association that became possible, and were being, you know, and we were thinking that through in the 2000s, and that the book sort of comes out of that sequence, which in a way reaches a kind of high watermark with the Occupy movement in 2009, and I was, you know, I was very much not very much involved with that. That sounds too self-aggrandizing. I was there, and I was trying to help insofar as I could, and then I think an increasing disaffection with politics, which is common to, I think, a lot of people over the last, you know, 10-12 years. It's a complicated question. Yeah,
awesome. So starting with Rousseau, you mentioned something which is to me sounded very original, and a lot of Rousseauists focus on that. That's the idea of décalage, like the displacement, the moments of tensions, you say ambiguity or seeming contradiction. You maneuver on that. Can you go into a little details of what it is and why it is important?
It's really following up from a brilliant essay by Althusser on Rousseau's social contract, which I hadn't really read until the early 2000s. I had it, but I'd not really read it. And I was becoming, you know, I've always been fascinated with Rousseau, just at the level of, you know, the texts and what they're doing and the kind of contradictions that are involved in those texts. Althusser puts his finger on a kind of series of displacements, slippages in Rousseau's texts, and so I became fascinated with that and began to. In fact, I only taught this once. I was teaching Rousseau, I think, in 2006 at the New School, and then you know, I think that Rousseau is a much more important figure politically than Marx, say, politically, in terms of how we think about politics and what it means to be involved in, what politics actually involves, and the institutions of a political regime. And yeah, so that was, you know, and it goes back further than that. I mean, but Rousseau, I find, you know, in terms of the self-consciousness of what Rousseau is doing, the extraordinary intelligence and self-awareness that he's doing something which at the same level is preposterous and is involved in all sorts of contradictions of which he is completely aware. And yeah. you follow that. And the contradiction that I'm kind of following through in the book is the contradiction between politics and religion, that the idea of politics that Rousseau wants to defend is an idea of association or popular sovereignty, which is the way in which a people declares itself into existence, if you like, and that requires no exterior support, religious, metaphysical support. And yet, exactly. at the same time, he engages in this discourse on what he calls civil religion. And this got me thinking about the relationship between politics and religion in Rousseau, and then more generally in the world. And so that was kind of what got me started, I think, in the
law. You also call him the most self-aware of his own fiction, which is amazing. Like he knows the fiction he's weaving, and still he believes in it.
Yeah, or still he does it. Yeah, he's to that extent. He's I think Rousseau and Nietzsche are the two most, if you like, self-conscious artificers of their own enterprise. They know exactly what they're doing, and there's an extraordinary reflexivity in what Rousseau's up to, which comes out in a particularly extreme way in his autobiographies, where Rousseau is kind of at war with himself. Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques, you know, this second autobiography where he, so the idea of, I think, you know, in many ways being a, not a philosopher, that's a bit too much, being a thinker is, you know, is always to be a war with yourself. And so if you're looking for progenitors of that, then Rousseau is very good to spend company, very good company to spend time in. And we can learn a lot.
Excellent. And one of the things you really like him is the Catechism of the Citizen. By the way, I found something, and you also mentioned Sergei Nechayev, and but I researched him and a little bit, and he has a Catechism of a Revolutionist, and in it, I want to read just the first sentence of his Catechism of the Revolutionist. It says, number one, the revolutionist is a person doomed. I found out that doomed in his original Russian was obrechenyi. I'm looking forward to all the Russian-speaking people telling me that I butchered the word. apparently, in order usage, this Russian word means consecrated also. So doomed and consecrated. I found it fascinating that even somebody as ascetic as him knew that they could go together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, yeah, that's interesting. A kind of a doom, which is a sacralization. Yeah. And he came to a rather unpleasant end. And there's stories about Nechayev, about whether he even existed and whether he...
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, and whether he was... whether that text, the Catechism of the Revolutionary, is intended sincerely or as a kind of parody. There's some debate about that, but it's a fascinating text, and also I think a deeply it's instructive in terms of warning us about the extremities of, if you like, a political speech, right? There's a, you know, Nechayev as there's a kind of, you can see the kind of spirit of Nechayev in, you know, the kind of enthusiastic excitement of various, you know, political figures, whether they're on the right or the left. I think that should give us some pause you should give us some. It's a very interesting text as well. Very short.
Very short. Yeah. But Kunin makes fun of him, right? Like he says, you sound like a Chechen gorilla right now. Makes fun of him after he writes the Catechism, apparently.
Yeah, I think that's also worth thinking about that there's something about the if you like the extremity of political speech, you know, the which has been accelerated and exacerbated by the way in which we engage in these abstract forms of activism online, which of course just rolling up and people say more and more excessive things. It's to that extent, you know, we need to cool down a bit.
Definitely.
If you look at what's happening rather than make judgments about it, I think Nechayev is a good early instructive lesson in what to avoid in forms of excessive political speech.
Yeah. In Jules and Jim, the movie, there's a story that a lady starts writing to a soldier, like randomly, that they don't know each other, and little by little they fall in love, and it gets harder for them to stay away from each other, and it gets like a burning love in both of them. They have never met, and the love between them is getting worse and worse, like the burning part of the love, which is amazing. The same thing with the online activism that you're saying, like the
yeah, and also with Julie Jim, is that Godard or is that Truffaut?
No,
Truffaut. Okay, well, Truffaut, yeah, but the film which really
two people fall in love is Jean Moreau. There's one thing that you have said in other places, and obviously is very important to you, and Rousseau says it also. Rousseau sees or acknowledges the motivational inadequacy of a purely philosophical account of politics and offers the picture of a political religion. So from philosophy, from the theory to actual commitment. See, that part of what he calls religion? Because it's not actually religion, right?
Well, yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It's. I'm broadly against political philosophy, right? In the sense in which I don't really know what a lot of political philosophy really does or thinks it's doing, and the approach I take in Faith of the Faithless is it's genealogical. It's historical.
Yeah,
historical work is hugely important, not necessarily my own but other people's. I think that we also require a formalism, a certain formal understanding of the nature of political institutions. Rousseau gives us a very compelling picture of that in The Social Contract. And then we need two more things. We need an account of practices, an account of customs, what Rousseau calls les mœurs, you know, mores, and we need some theory of persuasion. We need rhetoric in order to persuade people of why they should adopt a certain political view. So those four elements of genealogy, formalism, customs and persuasion, I think, are what takes the place of political philosophy as it's usually understood. And I stand by that. And I think Rousseau is very good, is very instructive in that regard. And I think that the key thing for Rousseau, for me, maybe the key thing in his work, is that you can't get anywhere in politics without an account of habits, of limus, of morals, of practices, of actual things that people actually do in social life. And you have to, the task of a theorist, if you like, or a task of a thinker is not to eradicate those practices in the name of some, you know, revolutionary transformation, but to take those practices, observe them, understand them with the kind of detail of an anthropologist, and then to try and see if they can be molded into something else. So a religion in that sense will be just, you could say, would be the name for the that total structure. Yeah. You know, religion would be that which would persuade people to act in a certain way, would give them a kind of a deep motivational commitment. So I begin, you know, in not I assume in this book, but it's argued more clearly in Infinitely Demanding, which is the book that leads this book, that, you know, the problem that we face is a motivational deficit in Western liberal democracy. And how do we face that? And that requires an understanding, a theory of ethics. And so that's kind of where I begin from. Yeah.
Excellent. So you also say to understand politics, we have to begin from sacred violence. So Rousseau talks about the citizenship, the politics, and the religion, but we also have to talk about the violence, because that's the three main topics you're covering, right? So sacred violence. You name some of these modern ideas in politics, you name them in the book in relation to sacred violence. I'm just going to name them if you want to.
Give me the page and I can find it. I can follow you.
The part about. Sorry, I have to find and then write the number of the page. But can I read the if I read the part, you probably remember what I'm talking about. You talk about Zionism, Islamism or jihadism, military neoliberalism, and social democratic conversion. You obviously have a lot to say about the sacralization of all political ideas, but especially violence, right? So in other places, you also make this distinction between what you call passive nihilism and active nihilism. I think they're in the same vein, I suppose. That's also helped me a lot, actually, with understanding violence, because I'm working on political violence in my PhD thesis. So, okay. So yeah, I mean, if you like, you can talk about a little bit about passive versus active nihilism.
Okay, well that's easy. I mean, that's that distinction I kind of borrow from Nietzsche in the notes to the Will to Power, and he talks about you could be a theologian, you could believe in God, and that God is present in kings and queens. You could believe that. You could, but the situation that Nietzsche describes is one where he thinks that the process of enlightenment has led to a dissolution of values, and that dissolution of values produces a kind of shock or an effect, which is the shock of nihilism, the uncanniest guests, he calls it, in Will to Power. And so Nietzsche isn't endorsing nihilism, he's describing it as a pathology of the modern world, that the modern world is dominated in nihilism. And to affirm, to say that all is nothing, all is lost, is the nihilist position. And he associates that philosophically with the work of Schopenhauer, with whom he had complicated relationships. But so the difference between active and passive nihilism is that if we begin from the idea that there's nihilism, we're living in a nihilistic world, then one response to that is passive, that we just say, well, everything is nothing. We'll just turn ourselves into a little island in this sea of troubles, in this kind of sterile promontory, as Hamlet would say, of the world. And we engage in, you know, practices of pleasure, of self-improvement, you know. And I've got this whole understanding of, you know, kind of New Age, Western New Buddhism. Age practice. Yeah, Western Buddhism as a kind of passive nihilism, which doesn't make any kind of excessive demands. And I think it's a misunderstanding of religion, but that's by the by. And active nihilism, which is that if everything is nothing, then we need to tear it down, we need to destroy it. And that's the kind of Nietzscheev position and I think they're both wrong. there's that. So I think that the passive nihilism is a very good diagnostic tool. It makes a lot of sense. It's very attractive. You know, everything is falling to pieces. The world is at war, and I can just focus on myself and what makes me and make myself into a little island of bliss. And active nihilism is the attempt to tear that down. And I think hypothesis or idea is that you know, there could be a revaluation of values
or suggestion,
which would be an overcoming of nihilism, and that would involve something like eternal return. But it's never really spelled out in completely full terms in Nietzsche's work. It remains suggested.
Yeah, one of the problems I have with the layman understanding of Nietzsche is that he said God is dead. He said, no, he said we killed God. Now what? We should think of something else now. But everybody thinks about the first part, which is God's dead.
Which is just basic Christianity. God is dead. God died last Friday. You know, it was Good Friday.
Good Friday.
What do we do now? So, but for Nietzsche, Nietzsche is, he's a hyper moralist. You know, he detests morality, Christian morality, but what he wants in its place is an even more kind of intense moral position, a kind of affirmative notion of valuation, which will be based upon ideas of power and so on and so forth. So yeah.
Which you're
sacred violence. Sacred violence. So you go first.
Oh, sorry. No, you actually say even that was precursorily mentioned by Rousseau.
Yeah. He was aware of that problem. And for Rousseau, the book is, how would I put this? The stuff about sacred violence is really the way in which, this is written in the early 2000s, but it's still sadly true, the way in which politics has become increasingly linked to forms of metaphysics, forms of quite traditional metaphysics, and where citizens or participants are kind of cosmic warriors who are then justified in acts of violence, of war, and that these are kind of, these have a quality of sacredness. And the examples I listed are different ones that we could talk about. What I think that reveals is, I'm deeply suspicious of sacred ideas of violence, but I think it reveals the fictional force which is at the basis of political organization, political institutions, and we need to understand that and then think about what to do with that fictional force. We live to live in a political world, as we do, as we have to, is to live in a world of fictions, things which were made, what Hobbes calls the artificial man, right? The Leviathan.
Leviathan, yeah.
And that's a fiction. That's something we do. And we have to understand that historically in terms of its relationship to practices, morality, and if we want to change it, we have to think about how that might be changed in very concrete terms.
Excellent. So let's get to a little more sunny side of the book. Millenarism, the movement of the free spirit. I love that part. That was my most favorite part of the book. Roald van Egem comes in. Situationism comes in. That's so what's your interest in
mystical anarchism? Now this began in an interesting way. In many ways the book is, I mean, it's experiments in political theology, but the four pieces in many ways are quite distinct. They're quite separate. There could have been, you know, four small books. I mean, the book on the Rousseau part came out as a book on its own in German, which I was quite pleased with. It looks quite good as a little book on Rousseau. Mystical anarchism, I began to get interested in the relationship between politics and sin, really, and the idea that, whether you're and kicking off from people like Carl Schmitt, that the difference between, say, authoritarians in politics and anarchists turns on their conception of human nature, and whether you think human beings are wicked or you think the human beings are decent and good. And if you think they're wicked, you end up as an authoritarian. If you think they're good, you can end up as some kind of anarchist. And then so I was thinking about that in relationship to Schmitt. And then I began to, someone I've really enjoyed reading over the years is John Gray, someone who's really not known in any kind of interesting way in North America. And his book, Straw Dogs, is an incredibly powerful critique of liberalism, and he comes back to an idea of human beings as defective, as sinful, as flawed, as what he calls homo rapiens, rapacious animals. And then I met John Gray at a certain point in maybe 2007 and talked with him, and then I was already reading it.
How did that go?
I was pretty good, actually. He had all sorts of interests in, he was in the same kind of poetry, and he was very interested in Wallace Stevens, and I'd written a book on Wallace Stevens. So we had a lot to talk about. It was good. But he was very close to and influenced by this man, Norman Cohn, who wrote this really definitive book called Pursuit of the Millennium in the late 50s and then revised in the late 60s. And really, this is an account of how there is this... There is this phenomenon of what he calls mystical anarchism, which he traces to the Middle Ages, and this idea that we can live in a kind of sinless union with others, in a kind of free brotherhood or sisterhood, and there'll be no power relations, and there'll be consensus, and everything will be fine. And for somebody like Norman Cohen, this is the most terrible kind of delusion in politics. And so he traces a story that goes from the heresy of the free spirit, or the doctrine of the free spirit, the movement of the free spirit in the 13th century in corners of Northern Europe in particular, through to 60s radicalism, through the idea that we can just get rid of morality and we can live in a kind of sinless communism. And that's a story he tells. And this got me interested in the phenomenon of mysticism, which has had very significant implications in the last 10 years for me. So I've just finished a book on mysticism, which it's in the finishing stages. It's all written, fiddling with it. But it began with this kind of critique of mystical anarchism, and then I just began to really rethink that. And then I remember doing this in this was a strange moment. The core of the mystical anarchism chapter I wrote very quickly without teaching any of the material. One December, must be around 2008 and 2007 maybe. And then I went to Toronto. I remember going to Toronto, and it was a very, very cold January. And I presented this material in this kind of art space and the crowd really, they really got into it, and I thought, oh God, there's something here. This is, you know, people get really excited about this idea of mystical anarchism. So I then began to think more about that. And then, you know, at the end of that chapter, I used this idea of mystical anarchism as a way of thinking about what was going on in the art world and what's called relational aesthetics on the one hand, and then with movements like the Invisible Committee and forms of anarchism, anarchist organization that were happening particularly in France but also elsewhere in the early 2000s. And I see the same mystical anarchist temptation recurring in different forms. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
And you call them some of them, like the Invisible Committee stuff, you call it mannerist situationism, right?
Yeah, mannerist, in the sense in which I think, you know, mannerism is interesting in the sense in which, by mannerism here, I mean in terms of, say, the history of art, the way that someone like Caravaggio stands to Michelangelo or to Raphael, in the sense in which In Caravaggio, you've got the same images, the same, say, biblical images, but they're bloodier, they're more violent, they're more extreme, and they're more distant from the actual religious practices. So it's something, as a possibility, as it were, recedes in distance from us as a lived possibility. The reenactment of it becomes more and more violent and more extreme. And so I think, so mannerism I see as a, so the Invisible Committee are a kind of mannerist situationist group. They want to be like the situationists, but the social reality of that in, you know, France 15 years ago allowed a more minimal form of expression to that. And that then led them to kind of really exaggerate. The rhetoric becomes more inflated. And I see that a lot with the contemporary revival of Marxism. Marxism becomes more manneristic, more extreme and exaggerated and violent in its rhetoric as it recedes as an actual possibility, okay. Actual lived politics. So I think that's a real problem, that we just end up ventilating these positions. And I think it's also the whole set of phenomena linked to that on the right, you know, that we could think about, those endless stories about, you know, race war that's coming to the civil war, the race war that's coming, and it's going to be like Book of Revelation. It's going to be war and bloodshed, and then the pure will survive and the impure will be, and that rhetoric kind of infects left and right, it seems to me. And it's it has to be understood and diagnosed, but I think it's a problem, let's just say.
And part of it, I just want to mention very fast, you lovingly talk about the Makit poet, and reading it, I was thinking, oh my God, this is Mansur Halaj. Actually, Halaj lived like 300 years before that, but like to hack and constant hacking and hewing yourself so that you're emptying yourself so that God, you become God. I mean, one of the reasons they killed him, Mansur Halaj, so badly was he kept saying, I'm God, and I'll have in Arabic. Yeah.
I'm very interested in that tradition, that tradition yeah. as it appears in, you know, early Islamic mysticism, in Christian mysticism, in Jewish mysticism, in all sorts of a sense of self-deification.
Yeah.
And that has led, you know, the mysticism book that I just finished is really kind of where that goes. I've been really trying to think those questions through. I take it seriously. I mean, I think there are ways in which the attempt to become God, become divine, is compelling insofar as what you're trying to leave behind is an idea of self, a kind of a decreation of the self or an undoing of the self in order to be incorporated into something other than yourself, something larger. So I think self-deification is very easy to criticize. It's more interesting to kind of understand it. And it's a rich and deep and interesting tradition.
Very quickly, do you see it an antidote to Western Buddhism?
Well, it could be if it was taken. I mean, I like my religion, like I like my yogurt, kind of thick and creamy. And my coffee, which is heavily caffeinated. And so I think that the problem with Western Buddhism isn't a problem with Buddhism. I mean, Buddhism is its own really complex tradition, set of traditions that originates as a kind of reformation movement against forms of Hinduism. And it, you know, the texts are fascinating. And but the way in which that is adopted in the West, I think it makes me extremely suspicious, because it seems to allow for a form of decaffeinated religion in the name of spirit, in the guise of spirituality. I mean, largely I'm against spirituality talk, and I'm very much in favor of religion talk, because religion is thick and creamy and difficult, and it's different in different places. I mean, there are all these similarities between religious traditions, but there are these huge differences. It's the differences that are as important. So I think the Western Buddhist position is kind of to take all of the difficult metaphysical stuff out of religion and just turn it into some kind of undemanding, vague spirituality, which is actually usually just selfish, in my view.
You call it the Bible according to me, right? Which is a fantastic title.
Yeah, I was going to write a book called Against Buddhism at a certain point, but it never happened. It didn't really have. It didn't work. But it was a nice idea.
Would have been nice.
I don't really have that much against Buddhism. That's the thing. But I'm against the way in which, if you like, the individualization of religious practice in places like the United States, the emphasis upon forms of spirituality, moral betterment, but only in this atomized way, and how that actually really is a mask for selfishness and a complete absence of forgiveness and mercy when it comes to others. If there's one thing that I really take from the Abrahamic faiths, it's mercy, forgiveness, and human beings screw up. That's for sure. In which case, if they repent of their sins, they're forgiven. And that's the striking thing for me, you know, about the New Testament, regardless of everything else, that people will come up to Christ and ask for various, you know, things, or ask, I've heard that you do these great things. You bring back the dead, you turn water into wine. And he will say, well, do you repent of your sins? And say, yes. And if that's sincere, then you are forgiven. And you give everything away and you live a Christian life. That's, and of course, that's not what people want to hear. They want their sins forgiven without changing anything. Terrible.
Yeah. Which brings us to the second most important historical figure in your book, I suppose. That's the dude formerly known as Saul. A Hebrew, born of Hebrews, under the law, blameless. He's an inquisitor who was whacking these new fanatics of the Christianity. He decides to go to Damascus, of all places. And then on the way, he sees an apparition, who is not Hamlet's dad, by the way. But so he sees an apparition and says, who are you? And says, well, dude, what are you whacking my people for? I'm Jesus Christ. And says, oh, my God, you're real? So he changes. He changes and he becomes one of the most radical churches in the history of Christianity, I suppose. Why is he so important to Heidegger, Badio, Agamben, you? I'm guessing Zizek because he writes about everybody. So why?
For me, it's I think probably for two reasons. That the intrinsic interest in Paul's letters, that as the founding documents of Christianity, which they are, the oldest documents of Christianity, which precede the Gospels, and the strangeness of what he says, you know, how should you act in the world? You should act in the world as if it were not, you know, as if it were not, in order to orientate yourself, direct yourself to the world which is to come, which is also not. There's a kind of double nihilism in Paul, which is really just figuring that out, the radicality of that, and its social implications. For example, Paul has no interest in the family and in society. You know, if you're married, well, fine, but if you're thinking of getting married, don't get married. Remain in the condition in which you were called, he says in Romans. Remain in the condition in which you were called and wait. So this disposition of this messianic disposition of waiting. And then the second reason is that I've had a long-standing interest in Heidegger, and I'm sort of a Heideggerian. And when I read Heidegger's lectures on Paul, then a kind of, at a moment of a sort of a Damascus moment, thinking, oh yeah, of course, the whole structure of Heidegger's thinking in Being and Time is a redescription of Paul's letters, and it just makes much more powerful sense. And also, you begin to see Heidegger as a kind of messianic thinker in ways that are both dangerous and compelling. So that's the second reason. So I used Paul to kind of rethink Heidegger's entire early work in ways which I think are really more compelling than the ways in which Heidegger is normally understood. So yeah, and that would be a kind of partial answer. And Paul is just, you know, Paul is just fascinating. And here you've got an idea of religion as really small scale churches, a kind of set of anarchist communes sprinkled across the Roman Empire, which are at war with that empire. And so Paul is, you know, if you want to think about politics and activism, then you can do no better than read St. Paul, it seems to me.
Yeah, God as an anarchist, right?
God is a kind of anarchist. That's, yeah.
Like I said, I have 20 more questions, but I would have to let you go. Just one last one, if possible. The gist of the book, nonviolent violence, and that's very important to you. So yeah. If you go ahead and tell us what it is and how to achieve it, please.
Right. It's a little bit of background on this, that the in Infinitely Demanding, I worked out, I think, I mean, to my satisfaction, to, you know, a theory of ethics and a theory of how ethics is orientated around what I call an infinite demand, which a subject accepts, takes into themselves, and then forms themselves as an ethical subject. And I try and describe that in detail, and I was still fairly happy with that. And then I tried to link that to a whole theory of politics in Infinitely Demanding, which was is fine. There's some good stuff in there. There's an interesting reading of Marx, I think, in Infinitely Demanding. And then I end up with this embracing a position of nonviolence, generalized nonviolence. And then really what happened was talking with friends in New York and some students who were long gone, but very interesting generation of students were sort of taking me to task on this and saying, well, you know, a generalized ethic and politics of nonviolence is pointless because we live in a violent world. So, you know, as I think Raymond Williams said, it's a great phrase where he says, to say peace when there is no peace is to say nothing. To say peace when there is no peace is to say nothing. So an affirmation of nonviolence is kind of empty. So can there be a relationship between like kind of a general ethic of nonviolence and politics which can be strategically violent? And how would you think that out? And that's what I try and do in the last chapter. Against on the one hand, you know, forms of simple pacifism, and on the other hand, against forms of discourse which celebrate violence in this kind of manneristic way. And that's the way I'd see someone like Zizek is kind of, you know, yeah, violence is cool, let's smash things up. So, but is there a way of of engaging in you know, if you like, the good violence that's against violence? Is there a way of thinking about a form of war that would be against war? And I followed that through by developing a much more anarchistic reading of Benjamin's critique of violence, and then looking at the strange relationship between nonviolence and violence in Levinas's work. And I think the position that leads to is on the one hand, there is an ethical commandment to nonviolence, to peace, but that doesn't exclude the possibility that there could be a necessity for certain acts of violence at certain times. Those acts of violence can't be celebrated or justified. They just might become necessary at certain historical junctures. And as I was just trying to make a case for thinking about the relationship between nonviolence and violence in those terms. And that's what I was trying to do at the end of the book. Whether I was successful, it becomes a question. What do I say? Let's see. It's you know, it's how we think together. It's how we think together this infinitely demanding conception of ethics with the necessity to be involved in strategic acts which might be violence at certain junctures, and so not to use non-violence as a kind of blanket position. This always happens with protests. There'll be a non-violent protest will begin in in Tehran or in Kiev or whatever it might be, and then provocateurs will mix with that crowd, and then there'll be some act of violence. Someone gets beaten up or whatever it might be, and then the media will say, well, you know, you're hypocrites. You proclaim nonviolence, but you engage violently. I think we need a more subtle and nuanced understanding of violence and the occasions on which that might be necessary.
Yeah, contextualize it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. From one bald, faithless man to his fellow bald, faithless man. I thank you profusely, Simon, and hope we can do it again. Sorry, I didn't hear that.
We're even dressed alike.
Yeah, kind of. I do. Awesome. I just want to quote Dr. Cornel West for our listeners. Dr. West says he loves Simon Kersley and he reads him. Dr. Cornel West reads Simon Kersley relentlessly and religiously, and I think everybody should do that. Thank you, Simon.
Well, thank you very much, Mehdi. Thank you very much for speaking to me.